Good evening. My name's Philip Jenkins, and as was mentioned, I wrote a book called God's Continent. And when I was writing the book, I told people it was about religion in Europe, and this being in the United States, of course, everyone commented, oh, it must be a very short book. And I'd like to think, no, it was not. But I was asked to speak about yesterday's realities. I was asked to speak about history, because I am a historian. And I'm going to do that, but I emphasize that what I have to say is relevant to today, for this reason. Why do I study history? A very simple reason. Everyone in the world knows a vast amount of history. All the students I ever teach know all the history in the world. My job is to tell them the right history. And that wrong history, if you like, the story of myths and legends, is not just bad in itself. It's not just because untruth is bad, but because I would suggest to you it is one of the greatest obstacles to any attempt to spread or proclaim Christianity. Because a particular view of history, a particular myth of history, has become such a potent rhetorical weapon against any kind of Christian story. And sometimes that is malicious, but sometimes it's accidental. And just to give you an idea, recently, of course, a few years ago, there was the issue of the European Constitution and whether it would include a reference to God. And in fact, the phrase that they ended up with was far, far worse than not even mentioning religion, because it had something rambling about Europe was founded on the glories of classical civilization, comma, the spiritual impulse, comma, and that's the whole history of Christianity in Europe. Where does Europe come from? Well, the first reference to the word European is kind of interesting in the modern sense. My colleague Vishal here mentioned the idea of Zeus and Europa. The first reference to Europeans has a date. It's the year 730, and it's very simple. There were Christian Frankish forces fighting Muslim Arab forces, and the chronicler didn't know exactly what to call the Christians, so he just called them the Europeans. So in other words, the whole concept of Europe is absolutely rooted in this idea of Christianity. More recently, and this is something that I'm going to say again and again, you're going to get really bored with hearing me say this, if you want to see Europe's Christian history, Christian roots, look around you. Everywhere you go in this city, in any European city, you'll see the European flag. You know, the blue background and the gold stars. What is that flag? It's interesting. Jeff Fountain, my colleague here, has worked a lot on the founders of the European project back in 1950. I am expressing my view here. It's not his view, but there are many people who believe the following. The founders of the European model were profoundly rooted in Christian and specifically Catholic ideology. We agree on that. But what they did then was they created a perfect European Christian flag, which was the traditional image of the Virgin Mary on the blue background surrounded by the crown of stars, and of course took out the Virgin Mary, because anyone in that year, 1950, which was a holy year, this great age of devotion to the Virgin, knew what it meant. So whenever you look at the European flag, and if you can go 5 minutes around here without seeing it, congratulations, think of two things. What that flag is a symbol of the Christian intent of that European Union, but also with the Christianity taken out. And that's quite a strong kind of symbol of Europe as it actually developed. My colleague Vishal also referred to films on a number of occasions. I also do this a great deal. I belong to the school of thought that believe that real life is an artificial support for those of you without the nerve to face the cinema. And not long ago, there was a film, a children's film, called The Book of Kells. If some of you may have seen this. It was very interesting. It was an absolutely beautiful film revolving around the ancient Irish Celtic manuscript, the Book of Kells. And, you know, don't get me wrong. I'm not attaching great significance to this as a work of art. This is not Lawrence of Arabia. But if you watch the Book of Kells, it was fascinating. It was about these, what shall I call them? Mysterious, noble, robed scholars who might just have been monks, but it's never clear, who live in a settlement and are designing these beautiful books with magnificent pages, and it's never clear why. And it's never clear what the ideology is that they are representing. And in fact, the whole plot of this story revolves around making the ultimate sacred part of this manuscript, a manuscript so powerful that when it is open, a mysterious light flashes out and destroys evildoers. And the key pages, and they speak this name in reverence, it is the Cairo page. Now, for those of you who know this, Cairo are, of course, the first two letters of the name Christ. But that connection is never drawn. So what you have here is a popular work about an entirely Christian manuscript created by an entirely Christian community. It is one of the greatest treasures of Christian Europe. And anyone seeing the film, anyone seeing the story, would not know that unless they knew it from other sources. It is, in fact, if you like, the European flag with the Virgin Mary left out. I don't attach any great attention to one particular children's film, which incidentally is very well worth seeing. But my question is this, and again, I refer to what my colleague Vishal said here, and what Jeff Fountain said here, if you did not know that about the Christian heritage, where would you know it? How would you know this? Because certainly in popular culture, Christianity features as the subject of a great many myths, what we can call, if you like, a black legend. And that legend, those myths, are the ideas and the assumptions that are in the mind of people you may be trying to talk to about Christianity. You may be saying, well, why is history useful? You may not care enormously about history, but the people you are talking to often have a whole historical, mythological system in their brains, and the problem is it isn't correct. I come back to this remark about look around you. I urge you, when you walk around any European city, just look around you. And there are so many things that you take for granted, and unless you actually take the trouble to find out what they are, you will not know, and you will not realize that every paving stone you tread on is rooted in a deeply Christian past. About a block from this convention center, just at random, is a square, a very undistinguished square, named Vilmos Apor. And you may look at that and think, what is this name? Hungarian for outsiders is a very difficult language. Bishop Apor was one of the greatest modern Christian saints. a man who maintained his absolute integrity, his sanctity, against the two greatest evils that faced Europe in the 20th century. He was a Hungarian bishop of Győr at the time that Hungary was allied with the Third Reich. That did not stop him writing regularly to anyone who would listen to defend and assert the rights of the Jews. When the Soviet forces overwhelmed the country in 1945 and committed a mass orgy of rape, he gathered all the women and girls and children of his city and gave them sanctuary in his cathedral until Soviet forces came along and murdered him in his cathedral. When you walk by any square, when you walk by any street, when you walk by any Holy Ghost, Holy Spirit way, any St. John's Street, any Paternoster way, it cannot fail to tell you that Christianity is the roots of Europe. I'm sorry. A spiritual impulse is the roots of Europe. Please excuse me. Many of you are familiar with the idea of the United States being a country that embraces public secularism. You know, for instance, the Supreme Court in the United States, the federal courts, try to maintain a strict separation between church and state. Americans also strangely have an idea of Europe as being a haven of ultra-liberalism. Sometimes I tell Americans about some conditions in Europe and they look at me in disbelief. And I say, well, you know, in Europe, for example, in many liberal European countries like Denmark, like Holland, they have all these religious holidays as public holidays. You know, Pentecost is a day off. I was once in Denmark and the city had, Copenhagen had come to a halt because it was Common Prayer Day. And I tell this to Americans and they say, so they live in a theocracy? I say, well, not exactly. The reason I think this is important, because Christianity, whether it is seen openly or not, represents such an enormously powerful cultural background, an ambience, whether we see it or not, and an underlying culture that makes Europe culturally Christian, even if not consciously so, and a series of religious images that can be appealed to. So the first thing I say is, look around you. The second thing is, look at how much of what you see when you do look around you contradicts familiar myths. What are the ideas that all secular-minded people, younger people, older people, educated people, what do they know absolutely for a fact about Christianity? Well, they know, of course, that Christianity is a religion of Europe and of European expansion. They know it is of European aggression against the rest of the world. It is a symbolic, ideological weapon of, if you like, tyranny. The image of the crusade is never far away. Look around you. Go up to the great castle here. Go to St. Matthias Church, which was a mosque for 150 years, for the long period that Christians debated whether Vienna would fall. Look at Luther's essay on the right of a Christian community to ordain priests and bishops, and note that he says, just imagine, for instance, when a Christian group is taken into captivity and they will never return, they have the right to ordain priests and bishops. Not if, when. Know that in North Africa, in the 18th century, there are probably 1 million Christian slaves. Please understand, I am not trying to assert the power of Christianity in history by creating Islam as a, if you like, a deadly enemy. But I am saying that Christianity was not always, was not for most of its history, the religion of expansion, of aggression, of empire in any sense. There are other things that everyone knows, probably the most important involve science. If you want to know the themes that will appeal to particularly, you know, younger people, educated people, well, there's one thing they all know about Christianity is they're not. Christianity was associated with the repression, the suppression of learning, of science. It was the power of Christianity, the power of the church, broadly defined, which kept Christianity in the Dark Ages, which, depending on which book you read, ended in 900 or 1900 or 1982 or at some point. And again, there are certain moments and images in this. Well, yes, there was Christian Europe, of course, but they knew nothing compared to the Muslim Arab Middle East. And then you try explaining patiently, as to a small child, yes, indeed, the Middle East in the Middle Ages, the Arab world, was an extremely sophisticated place. It had all the manuscripts of the ancient Greek scholars. It brought Aristotle into the Christian world. Where did those manuscripts come from? They were all translated by Christian scholars from Christian universities in the Middle East, like Nisibis and Junda Shaipur, who in the 8th century were all brought to Baghdad by the then caliph, who believed in bringing the world's best scholars together. They were the ones who translated the these great works of scholarship. They were the ones who saved Christian antiquity, and it was then the Arabs who brought them to Europe, from Christians to Christians. If there is a single image that summarizes the myth of, if you like, the Christian Dark Ages, you may have seen it. It's like this. It shows Queen Isabella of Spain. And here is Christopher Columbus holding up a globe. And over there are a bunch of primitive, fanatical monks and friars who are all saying, no, no, this is not true. The picture has been represented many, many times because, as everyone knows, the church in the Middle Ages believed that the earth was flat and you would sail off it. Once again, you can try explaining, as to a small child, no. All the way through the Middle Ages, the church taught happily that the world was round. There was a debate, however, about how big it was. Christopher Columbus believed that if he sailed 3,000 miles west of Spain, he would end up in Japan. The monks and the friars said, no, no, you've got your distances wrong. Who was right? Correct, the primitive, fanatical, Dark Age monks and friars. If you do not believe me, try it. You don't fall off the end, but you don't end up in Japan. And as I say, the church was correct on this. There are any number of other bits of mythology. There are the witch hunts, of course, which killed, what number would you like? 6 million people, 9 million people. Try about 100,000 over 500 years. It's a vast number, but it is on different orders of magnitude from the legendary figures. If anyone wants to talk about the rise of science in Europe, then I would not point to the church, to Christians, as being obstructionist. Instead, I would talk about science being a Christian project which continues through much of its developments, remarkably late being a Christian project. I refer to an idea which always fills me with awe, which is this. In the 1690s, the great British naturalist John Ray wrote a book with the title the works of God made manifest in his creation. And that is one of the most powerful Christian, in this case specifically Protestant, contributions to the knowledge of the world. The idea that when you investigated flowers or gravity or planets or geology, you were investigating the myriad treasures that God had left there for his followers to discover. It's that impulse, that spiritual impulse, that drives clergy like the great British geologist William Buckland, who basically creates the geological world of the 19th century, or my favorite, Charles Babbage, the man who invents really the modern-day computer in the 19th century, and writes a staggeringly ingenious text, mathematically based on why miracles are not only feasible but essential to the creation. An apologetic argument which still defies belief. And you say, this was by Charles Babbage, but wasn't he like a great scientist? How can he have been a Christian? This is not possible. What I am suggesting is that it is very important to know so many of these arguments. I mean, since our theme tonight is Europe, I won't go into the lengthy issue of bogus gospels and how the Roman Empire just tells the church which gospels to read, and the Da Vinci Code mythology and so on. But people believe many things which simply are not true, and it is so important to understand them in order to challenge them. But as I say, there is also a strictly practical agenda here, if you want to call it an evangelistic agenda, because it tells where people are coming from. It tells you what ideas that people have in their minds that you can speak to. In all those surveys about religion, there are all these people who say they do not believe in God as defined by the churches, but they believe in something. And so often, that something, that kind of holiness, that kind of spirituality, if you like, is defined by place and time, which in the context of Europe means a Christian place and time. And I'll just make one observation which will sound very strange. When I write a book about religion in Europe, when I write a book, and it must be a very short book, I make one point. Think of pilgrimage. Think of pilgrimage as an act. When was the golden age of European pilgrimage? 1300, 1400, try now. There's absolutely no doubt that in terms of the number of pilgrimage places, the number of new pilgrimage places, the volume and scale of pilgrimage, the greatest age is now, not 1960. In the 1950s, Lourdes got 1 million pilgrims a year. Now it gets 5 or 6 million. There are dozens of new pilgrimage places are opening up. Why are people going to these? It's not specifically for any connection with a church, with a religious affiliation. It is because of a sense of a search for sanctity, a search for holiness, a search for special place and special time, which, once again, I say, is in Europe what it has been for the last 1,500 years. It is not a spiritual impulse. It is a Christian message. It is an enormously powerful potential. And I think I have abused enough people with that, so at that point, I will stand down. Thank you very much.